Welcome to Ex Chateau.
Ex Chateau.
The podcast that navigates the business of wine with unique perspectives and insights. With your hosts, Robert Vernick and Peter Young.
Welcome to this episode of Ex Chateau. Today we're going to talk about the state of the wine consumer, which is a big topic for 2024. And with us is Liz Tosh, Master of Wine and the current president of the Wine Market Council. Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Liz and I go way back for a while, and we wrote a book together and all that kind of good stuff. But for those who aren't familiar with you, could you give a brief overview of your background?
Yeah, sure. I was actually born in California, but grew up in Idaho and New Mexico, and then came back to California to go to university. And then I worked after graduation, worked 10 years in industry, and then got a master's and PhD. And then eventually moved back to California and became a professor at Sonoma State University in their wine business program. So I just retired from there after 23 years teaching wine MBAs and wine undergrads. And I was retired for 2 months, and Wine Market Council came along and said, hey, would you like to run a nonprofit? It's not too much work. It's only part-time. So it's been a lot of work, but it's been fun. I think I enjoy the intellectual challenge because I've actually been using, as a professor, I used Wine Market Council research since I came to California, so starting in 2000. And because Sonoma State's always been a member. So Wine Market Council basically is a nonprofit and started in 1996. Our mission is to provide cutting edge research on the U.S. wine consumer purchasing habits, trends, and attitudes. And we've been doing that for years now. So obviously, as a professor and a researcher, the data they provide every year has been invaluable. It's also very useful for, of course, wineries, distributors, importers. You know, we have many members, and they use the data to help them develop marketing and brand strategies.
That's great. And so I guess we've had this negative backdrop for at least the last few months, if not the last couple of years, in the wine industry with the, we call it, neo-prohibitionist movement in full force, and getting the World Health Organization to say that zero alcohol is good for you and all that. Wine sales are starting to fall for the first time in decades. And I think that's a bit of a pivot in terms of like what data is coming out and how it makes the Wine Market Council's research on the consumer and the wine consumer even more important today than it's ever been. So I think a lot of people say that the decline in wine sales is because younger generations don't drink as much, like Gen Z and millennials. Does the research actually show that?
Actually, there's a number of factors for the decline in wine sales. And I like to sort of back up and start at the big picture. I show people a graph of wine sales, wine shipment, and wine consumption in the U.S. starting in 1934 all the way to today. And we've actually had some dips like this before, declines in wine consumption in previous times. In fact, there was a huge one actually during the 1990s. And again, we were facing some of the similar kind of factors. Anti-alcohol groups were increasing. There were excise taxes. Beer was really getting big. And so wine sales declined then, but then slowly started coming back. In fact, that's actually when part of the reason Wine Market Council started, we started in 96, was to help turn that around and to help promote wine, you know, in a positive, moderate, responsible way. So I think we were partially successful in that because then we spent about 20 years of great growth, nice, positive, upward growth in the industry. And then all of a sudden, right after COVID, COVID, the years were good. We actually had some decent sales in 20 and 21. So it wasn't until 22 that we started seeing this decline for the first time in volume sales. And then in 23, we also started to see it in actual dollar sales as well as volume. And so now the numbers for in 2023, the U.S. wine market declined in volume by 9%. So that's a pretty big drop. And again, we're looking at very similar kinds of issues that are impacting that. This anti-alcohol movement that's come up again, inflation. And probably another one that we don't talk a lot about is choices. There are so many more choices now for consumers than there were, you know, 20 years ago.
And just you bring up that history. For the times in the past where we've experienced these kind of drops, how long have they lasted? And what have been catalysts that have got out of it?
So they lasted about, it took us a while to climb out of that dip in the 90s and get back where we were. But there were several catalysts. One was actually the French paradox, which, as you know, now is being refuted. And then also introduction of new products also helped bring that about. You know, you had, I'm trying to think when White Zinfandel started taking off and, you know, the wine spritzers. So things like that, people started seeing new products. Merlot was getting really hot, and, you know, in those early 90s, and then eventually, you know, it went down. But there were certain things happening. And so I think we need some of that to happen again. The wine industry really needs to get more innovative. That's part of the solution to bring us out of this slump.
There's definitely a lot of RTDs and other things that could have wine in them and are taking off in popularity. I guess there's some innovation, at least.
Yeah, there's definitely. Wine RTDs is definitely one of the spaces we're recommending people look at. You know, not everybody can do those. Small producers, that's more challenging for them. But, you know, medium to larger producers can start creating some new brands around wine RTDs. There's a few who are doing it and are successful, but I think we need more people in that space.
So, but is the generational demographics and the shifting of that with boomers being big and then smaller Gen X and bigger millennials and Gen Z, is that impacting the consumption of alcohol and wine specifically?
Definitely. So every 2 years we do what's called our big benchmark segmentation survey on the U.S. wine consumer. We used to do it every year, but then it didn't really make a lot of sense. So we've now done 19 of those surveys. So we have the largest database on the U.S. wine consumer over that 27-year time period. And so we just, in fact, our research director, Christian Miller, just went back and did this huge longitudinal study looking back from 1997 to today to see how the consumer has changed and shifted over time. And, you know, the emergence of the millennial generation and now Gen Z and how they started out drinking and how they progressed. And so we were very fortunate with the boomers, but right now the boomers are drinking less. Finally, the millennials, especially older millennials in their 30s, are totally coming online. So this is a positive thing that actually hasn't been written enough about in the media, and we definitely want to start trying to communicate this better, because I think people have been saying millennials are attracted to wine, and we're finding now in our new data that they are. It just took them until their 30s to really start taking it serious, and in a couple of years, they're probably going to surpass the boomers. The boomers are drinking less. In fact, this latest study is showing us that 61% of boomers are cutting down on their alcohol intake. So this is happening faster than we expected. So part of it could be some of these anti-alcohol messages that are happening now. There could be other reasons. But the millennials are coming on. And Gen Z, it's interesting. We just did this analysis, so it's like hot off the press. And if you're a member, the benefit is you get to go deep into this analysis, and we can slice and dice the data any way you want. You know, we can look at your country, your state, your varietals, and generation, and ethnicity, and gender, and we can really give you detailed data. So that's one of the benefits of being a member. But we do share our high-level data like this. And so we discovered, and this was fascinating to me because I did see this, that Gen Z, when they first started turning 21, those first 3 years, they actually were adopting wine at very high levels, higher than the millennials had even had at that age. But then all of a sudden, in the last 3 years, Gen Z has just completely declined in all alcohol consumption. So among that generation, it's a trend right now with them where, and you know, part of it is sober curious movements going on. A lot of Gen Zs now will say, it's cool to be sober. There's all these, you know, social media sites about people talking about how to be sober and how it's cool to be sober and it's trendy to be sober. So that's part of what we see reflected with Gen Z, because they were actually doing really well. And then 3 years ago, that all changed.
3 years ago. So that'd be like 2021 or 2020.
I think it was right during the pandemic. And, you know, I do think that COVID and the pandemic definitely impacted people. In fact, some of the research on Gen Z says that they saw during COVID, and maybe, you know, they participated themselves depending on their age, a lot of people drinking. I mean, especially in the US, Brazil, Italy, certain countries, wine consumption went up, Argentina, and then other countries it went way down during COVID. But the US, we drank more. And I think part of it was people were fearful. You know, they were like, gosh, you know, I could die tomorrow. So I'm going to enjoy life today. I think that's part of what was going on. Wine sales were up. All alcohol sales were up. And then as soon as it was over, we, you know, sort of like a COVID backlash. Some people call it a COVID hangover. And I think this is normal when you look at human psyche and attitudes. It's like, okay, it's time to be healthy now. And I'm going to go on a diet. You know, I'm going to drink less alcohol, exercise more. And I think that's part of what we're seeing. And I think Gen Z at that time, you know, when COVID hit, I think the oldest one was only 23. Right now, the oldest one's only 26. And, you know, and I think another important thing to keep in mind with Gen Z is, let me just get this exact number for you. The percentage of Gen Z is still pretty low at legal drinking age in the United States. Only 33%. So actually 9% of Gen Z drink wine, but only 33% of the total population of Gen Z is 21 plus. So you still have, you know, another 67% of Gen Z coming online. So it's possible things can change that. And, you know, that's why we track trends, because trends in the environment, all types of trends, you know, impact consumption. And I think that's what we're seeing with Gen Z now. And it's not just alcohol that they're drinking less of. I mean, they're doing less of everything. They're driving less or driving later in life. They haven't adopted certain things that generally people in their 20s are doing. And the other thing they're really concerned about, which I think is a positive, my daughter's a Gen Z and she like fits to T all these things. She does drink wine, but she does it in moderation. Gen Z is very concerned about transparency in products, in labels, ingredients. They saw in their formative years, they went through some of those really bad food scares, food recalls. And so they were shaped by what happened to them. And so they're very concerned. They're concerned about the environment. They're concerned about global warming. So they're always looking at that. They're concerned about social equity. And these are all positive traits. These are great things. They can help change the world to be a better place. So right now, that's where they are, and we need to meet them where they are. That's why non-alcoholic wine options are doing so well in the market, not just non-alcoholic wine, beer, spirits, all of them. It's one of the booming categories in wine.
Do you think for those Gen Z, or I guess another way to put it is, how important are the messages like from the WHO around no alcohol is good for you? Because I would imagine that that impacts education for people when they're children. And just total perception. I have a friend who I spent some time with last summer, and he's got like, I think it was like a 9-year-old boy who was so anti him having any wine because he associated alcohol with poison. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming mm-hmm. he learned that at school, right? And so I'm wondering how impactful these high-level health messages are as they trickle down into the rest of population, especially into education.
That is a great question, Peter. And, you know, we haven't, since the World Health Organization has really only, I guess it's been in the last 3 years, they've been putting out these messages. And then last year alone that they came out with some of the really strict messages, such as no level of alcohol is healthy, which was picked up, of course, by the New York Times and many other media. And so I'm sure they've seen it, but we haven't yet done any kind of research on the impact of that. So I can't give you a set number or statistic. However, I'm assuming it's got to be impactful. I mean, these things that happen, these things that people see in their formative years, you know, on television, on social media, on wherever they're seeing it, definitely shape the way they view the world. I mean, just think about when you were growing up, what was happening then and how it shaped your perceptions. You know, that can change over time, you know, with education and with new experiences, but all of these things help create an individual person in the way they think and their friends. What their friends do, especially at that age, you know, in your young 20s, you know, especially college or high school, junior high, those are super formative years, and what your friends say and think, you often adopt to fit in.
Yeah. I'd love to dig a little into the millennial element you mentioned, where they're now participating in wine higher than they were earlier, a few years ago. Do Do you have any hypotheses as to, or research as to what is driving that? Is it later family formation or wealth creation or things of that nature?
Yeah, actually, that's something that we've, all of us in the wine industry, known for a long time, is that generally when people get in their 30s, they start to get married, have children, buy a house, have a mortgage. And so they're settling down, you know, a little bit more. In fact, in our recent research, 60% of wine drinkers are married and 71% own a home. 53% live in the suburbs. So, and wine is a drink of moderation. That's another thing. People, the main reason people drink wine in the U.S. is number one, for relaxation, and number two, because they think it's a drink of moderation. It is. So it's not a drink that you go out and party and get rip-roaring drunk with. You know, that's not really what wine's for. And so I think when you are at home, you're with friends, you have family and children, wine is, in your 30s, then wine is a very responsible drink to turn to. And then the third reason people drink wine in America is the taste. They really like the taste. And some people have to grow into that. And number four is for the social connection. So in social, it's drinking wine with friends, with family, around the dinner table. And also for romance, romance comes up pretty high with wine. Wine is considered to be probably the most romantic of beverages. And then, of course, within the wine category, sparkling and champagne are even higher in that.
Yeah, definitely. Now having a young family myself, there's definitely less travel and other things and more at home. Or I guess there would be more opportunities to drink wine, especially wine at home versus, you know, being on the road.
Yeah, right. And glass of wine in the evening is just sort of a way to treat yourself, you know, to celebrate the end of the day, to decompress and, you know, chat with your spouse or, you know, friends or, yeah. So I think that's why we're seeing millennials, because they're finally a large. So since the oldest Gen Z is 26, so then the youngest millennials are still in their late 20s. But so we have the bulk of the millennial population now in their 30s. And so that's why I think we're seeing this kind of behavior. It's pretty normal for people to start adopting more wine in their 30s. And they also have more money then. So keep, you know, wine is a little more expensive than beer and spirits to some extent, depending on which one you're buying. So they may not have the income. And so by the time they're in their 30s, they have more disposable income. And let's see, I think a small portion of the millennials are now in their 40s, early 40s. So you're even a little more stable then. So yeah, that's why we see this happening. We also see millennials, another thing, when we looked at price points, I know you talked a little bit about premiumization. We definitely see the millennials spending more money on wine. So when we look at what we call high-end consumers, people who spend $20 or more regularly on a bottle of wine, you have a large number of millennials in that population. Interestingly enough, you also have a large number of both Blacks and Hispanics will spend more on wine by occasion than white consumers.
Right, right. And maybe we can jump to that point. Wine traditionally has been, I'll put it in quote, but like a white person's drink. And I think that your data is starting to show that that's starting to change. Is that right?
Yes, this was one thing we were happy to see. So I asked Christian again to look at ethnicity and to do this longitudinal. We've actually never done the longitudinal survey, you know, where we go back and look at all of our surveys over the years and see how the U.S. wine consumers change. But I think maybe being an academic, when I came in, I'm like, why haven't we done this? This would be so cool to do this. So we have all the data. So Christian has been so wonderful. He's a brilliant researcher. So he went back and pulled, I mean, we had so many files and he did this analysis and it's just fascinating. And so we were able to see that, yes, even though we thought we hadn't made much progress in ethnicity, we have. And then, of course, he even looked at, you know, the demographics in the U.S. are changing. By 2050, we're going to be majority minorities. That sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Anyway, so yes, it used to be. So, for example, I think you saw some of the numbers. So right now, 66% of wine drinkers are white. And in the past, it used to be like 77, 78%. And then 15% are Hispanic, 11% are Black, 5% are Asian, and 3% are others. That's what it is right now in the U.S. And we have seen definitely increases in Black wine drinkers and Asian. when we compare that to U.S. Census numbers and indexing it by ethnicity in the United States. The one area where we haven't made as much progress is Hispanics. And this is concerning because actually they're going to be the fastest growing ethnic population in the U.S. So that's part of the reason why one of the huge research projects we have this year in Wine Market Council is how to attract more multicultural consumers, as well as how to attract more young adults. Because, you know, you have the Gen Zs not adopting. We are making progress with multicultural, but we definitely need to keep working on that. And so we actually did a study 2 years ago on this. And so we have some preliminary data on that and what we need to do. But we want to go deeper. We actually really want to try to start understanding more about what's happening. And so this is a huge, huge project we're getting ready to launch.
Well, Hispanics is super interesting given that the wine industry's backbone of labor is actually Hispanic for the most part, at least in California, but most of in the U.S. So I would hope that they would embrace wine more. But I mean, certainly that's a minority compared to the total population of Hispanics.
Right. And we also have a lot of very famous Hispanic-owned wineries. For example, Ceja, they were like honored at the White House. They're in the Smithsonian, you know, and they, the Cejas came to America from Mexico as migrant workers working in the vineyards, you know, Robert Mondavi. And now they own a very successful winery. They have obviously a very large population of Hispanic consumers. They do really wonderful. Ceja does a lot of what we need to do more of. They are linking wine to Hispanic cuisine. And talking about the whole food piece is, you know, really big with the different Hispanic, you know, there's so many of them. There's, you know, there's the Mexican American, there's the Cuban American, and so forth and so forth. And so you have all those different foods and they're linking wine to food. And that's very, very useful. It was one of the things that came out in our last multicultural research was link it to our food. How does it go with our food? How does it go with Asian food? And so that's one winery who's doing that very successfully. And we just need more of that.
Did that research show other ways besides food that the wine industry can embrace more diversity?
Yes. So let me pull that up real quickly. I'll just give you some of the ideas. Another one was ads that look like me. Mm-hmm. Okay. You think that would be obvious, but I still think we have a long way to go in the wine industry to have multicultural ads. You know, one thing is, the U.S. wine industry doesn't spend a lot of money on marketing, mainly because, you know, a lot of them, well, more than 60% are small little family wineries, you know, and so they don't have large marketing budget. But they do have social media, so they can do stuff online on YouTube that includes ads like me. So there's room for improvement there. I talked about the cultural aspects of wine and food. Another thing that is super important is that we found that when they come to visit the wine regions, wineries, that they want to see diversity in the workforce. They want to see people serving wine who look like them. They'd like to know that there's winemakers that look like them. So those were a couple of the main ideas. There are others, which I don't have right now off the top of my head. Well, maybe another one is pop-up events, which would be go where they are. I interviewed a really successful wine importer in Tucson, Arizona last year, and they're importing wine from Mexico. And so what they would do is they would do pop-ups at all of the Hispanic events in Arizona, and they'd partner with these taco trucks. They said, we have so many people who are coming up, and we would let them taste the wines, and they were so interested, especially in pairing it with Mexican food. So that's a really great example of being where the consumer is and fitting into their cultural components and respecting that culture and talking about how wine can link to it. So those are some of the things that even a small, that's a tiny little business doing that and making a huge difference. So even small wineries can start doing some of this.
For sure. And so premiumization in the wine industry has been a trend for a while. How is that changing with today's consumer?
Oh, yeah. So it doesn't seem to be going away. I think what's happening, again, is people are drinking less wine, but they are drinking better. They're deciding, okay, I'm not going to drink as much, but I'm going to drink well. And we saw this especially, last year we did the high-end consumer research, the people who consistently spend $20 or more on a bottle of wine. And the size of that audience in the U.S. is anywhere from 7 to 15% of the total U.S. population, sorry, not just of wine consumers. They said, we did a lot of qualitative, you know, why do you spend this much money on wine? You know, why is it important? And that piece was super important to them. They felt that by spending a little more, they were getting a very high quality bottle of wine that was more authentic, that had less additives, where they knew it came from a winery with an actual vineyard. You know, it wasn't a virtual brand, where maybe they'd visited and talked to the winemaker or did a virtual tasting with the winemaker. So they had a connection, and they felt it was an agricultural product. It was, you know, more natural, coming from the land. And that was very important to them, that they wanted to put something in their body that they felt really good about. So there's that whole transparency piece again. And so that's part of why I think you see this drinking less. So if I'm going to drink less, I'm going to drink better. And then also just the perception, which in many cases is very true, that the higher end wines are, you know, have less additives and so forth.
Is that trend of premiumization consistent across generations, or is it certain generations more than others?
Yeah, that was the other thing that was fascinating. We found that younger people are actually ages 21 to 30 actually were purchasing more high-end wine than we found with boomers. That boomers were actually, we did a statistical analysis on this and looked for a significant difference. And the boomers actually were starting to drop in their purchasing of more expensive wine, where the younger consumers were doing more of it. Granted, they weren't purchasing as much or as frequently, but they were more interested in the premiumization piece.
Did your research touch into where people buy wine, and has that changed recently?
Yes, we did. Still, the number two places people buy wine in the U.S. market is supermarkets/grocery stores and wine shops. But in terms of online wine sales, that has increased by 12%, up from 5% before COVID. So that's a pretty big, significant difference. And the other piece that was pretty startling to me was that 29% of consumers now purchase wine on their phone. So this is really important to have a great mobile website and shopping cart that's easy to use on the phone, just because of that. I know I've started purchasing wine on my phone myself. So I don't know, have you?
Yeah. I think that's purchasing everything.
Yeah.
And what about where people find out about wines? Like, how important is social media and mobile apps and wine discovery and buying?
Yeah, so we're finding that most wine consumers, in fact, it was like, I think 93% are on social media. So they're using some type of social media. And still, Facebook is the favorite, which I think is mainly because we still have a few more baby boomers, and baby boomers have a tendency to be on Facebook. But YouTube has gotten way up there. 61% use YouTube, Instagram 55%. What surprised us is, well, maybe this isn't so surprising, but X, which used to be called Twitter, has fallen dramatically. Twitter used to be number two, and now it's like down to sixth place. But before Twitter, way before Twitter, is TikTok. So that was really surprising to me. Because, you know, right now, wineries are not allowed to advertise on TikTok, but they can use influencers, but they themselves cannot advertise on TikTok. So 40% of wine drinkers are on TikTok, and 17% are using wine apps.
Yeah, the TikTok one is interesting. I guess that shows the still maintaining relevance of influencers versus sort of your own social media accounts.
Yeah, I think influencers are still are very important. And some wine brands have used them very successfully. I don't know if you're probably familiar with the Taylor's Port TikTok challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where they cause their sales. In fact, still this year, Danny Brager, who's, you know, on our advisory board and helps us present a lot, you know, he's the former Nelson VP of data analysis. He shared the wine categories that were selling the best this year, and port was still way up. And it was pretty much because of that. He said it's starting to come down, you know, now that that campaign has ended, but it spiked way up. And that was a TikTok play.
Well, the new Josh memes too, I think, started at TikTok.
Yep. Josh is one of those brands that's doing phenomenally well. Josh is doing a great job at really connecting with younger consumers, but still maintaining a nice older consumer base.
So what trends do you think the wine industry should keep an eye on for 2024?
Oh, wow. There's so many of them. I definitely think one of the things we're trying to do, you know, obviously the anti-alcohol movement is concerning to all of us. And of course, it's illegal in the United States to talk about health. So we cannot talk about health at all. But what we can do is we can talk about the benefits of wine. So we are, and there's a number of organizations who are focusing on this. We have a campaign at a Wine Market Council called Wine Is, and a social media campaign. We're on five, we just launched it December. We're on five different platforms, and we're focusing on all the positive ways people use wine. We're making this out of our research. We're looking at occasions. And so it's just a picture of somebody having fun with wine. And it might be wine is wine cocktails. Wine is family dinner. Wine is, you know, date night. You know, wine is a cozy fire. So all the different wine is a friend watching the game with friends, you know, those are the ones we've been using. And we're getting a really good response to that. So focusing on just all the positive ways people use wine and reminding people too that wine is an agricultural product, that we are close, you know, close to the earth, you know, that the wine tastes of the terroir and you can tell where it's from in many cases. So we're focusing on all the positive things about wine. So I think that's a really important trend for anybody who wants to achieve some positive wine sales in the United States. The other thing we were taking a look at is the whole transparency and ingredient labeling. We see a lot of wineries now voluntarily, you know, in the U.S., it's not yet a law like it is in the EU to list the ingredients and the nutrition. So we're seeing more and more of them starting to do this, and they're getting some positive reactions. Of course, the whole low, no alcohol movement is just really hot. That's one of the areas where you see lots of increased sales. So we see more and more wineries starting to do this, which I think is positive. There is resistance, and I understand why, because, you know, they're like, I spent all this time on this product, and it's so important to me, and it's so personal. I don't want to take the alcohol out of it. I'm worried about that. And I say, okay, fine. Don't take it out of those products, but create another brand and create a low or no alcohol option for consumers. I think this is going to become more and more important to our aging baby boomers, that they need those. That's one of the things we have a three-part strategic sort of emphasis this year. One is attract new, young, and multicultural consumers. Two, retain your existing consumers. And three, adopt motivation. You need to be more innovative. So with that group, they are starting faster than we thought to reduce their wine consumption, their alcohol consumption. So we need to make sure we're there for them, that we provide some solutions for them to keep them engaged. So I think that's a really important trend.
Mm-hmm. And what's surprising is most of the people who are drinking non-alcoholic wine are actually drinkers. They're not people who don't drink at all, but they're people who drink a glass of non-alcoholic wine in between their glasses of wine.
Exactly. And we found that. That was a huge finding in our research this year. We were surprised how many people are now wine drinkers who are drinking non-alcoholic wine, beer, and spirits. So we had, let's see, we had 48% say they're drinking less alcohol generally. And then of those, we asked them if they were drinking non-alcoholic, and 40% said they were drinking non-alcoholic spirits and cocktails. 35% said they're drinking non-alcoholic beer. Gosh, and some of that's really good. And 34% are drinking non-alcoholic wine. That's 34%. So drinking non-alcoholic every day or more than once a week. So it is. And I myself, I don't know if you've done that, Peter, but I've started doing that. There's some good ones out there now. You know, they could be better. There's definitely room for improvement. But I have faith. I mean, Americans are smart. We've always been able to be innovative. And if somebody puts their mind to it, you know, maybe with some university's help, you know, we can create some really delicious non-alcoholic wines.
Oh, yeah. No, I've tried many of them, and several of them are quite good. And sometimes I use it in that way, too. It'll be, you know, in between drinking regular wine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I would personally like to see that category grow, just as a consumer myself.
Yeah. There's a quality. Yeah. Quality price issue. Right. So what people are willing to pay and therefore how good the quality can be.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised how much the beer industry is investing in non-alcoholic beer. They see it as one of their major growth categories. And I really think that we need to do the same, more so than we've done. So that one, let's see, I think I'm getting most of the trends. I already talked about we need to do more wine RTDs and wine cocktails. Every time I say wine cocktails, I get another pushback from the wine industry. But I'm saying, okay, not you yourself. You don't need to create a product and put it on the shelves, but have it at your tasting room. When people walk in, offer them a wine cocktail to start. It's very common in Europe, you know, restaurants even, you know. There's so many great wine cocktails around the world. Nobody knows. Consumers don't even know, most consumers, that there are wine cocktails. There's such a huge opportunity there with that. I've heard some distributors are actually now teaching some of the bartenders about wine cocktails, which passing out recipes. I think we need to share wine cocktail recipes. I think that whole category is another option there. And then serving size. That's another big thing that came up in our research was that the growth of single serving wine is quite high. And so we need more of that. We need an easier way. It's that whole convenience factor. It's why people love RTDs, because it's a single serving in a can. It tells you how much sugar, calories, carbs are on it. I also think we need to do more of that. One of our most shocking discoveries we made last year when we did the year before we did the ingredient survey was that 50% of Americans think wine has added sugar. You know, and as we know, that is like it's almost not true ever. I mean, very few wineries add sugar to wine, but they think it has added sugar, which is just shocking. And then we also saw people said they were drinking less wine because they thought it had too much sugar. So I guess they not everybody knows about fermentation and how the yeast eat all the sugar. So this is a great opportunity. This is a great educational opportunity. And of course, the single easiest way to solve the problem is put it on the label. No sugar added. So it's quite simple. There are lots of simple solutions on low-hanging fruit for the wine industry, the global wine industry, because we support Wine Market Council. We have many international trade associations and importers who are members. And so we want everybody to be successful in wine sales, promoting wine in a responsible fashion. Wine is a drink of moderation that brings pleasure and enjoyment to life.
And on the serving size, you may not have done this in the research, but there are so many preservation techniques now or products that can help with that, even with a 750 bottle, right? If you think of Rebor or Corvin and all those products where you can actually just pour yourself a single serving and keep the wine for months.
Right, exactly.
But maybe they're not that well known. I don't know.
They're not that well known, and not all consumers can afford some of those price points.
For the preservation?
For some of the preservation systems, yeah.
Oh, because like the Rebors are just like corks and they're like, I don't know, $2, I think.
Oh, okay.
Dollar.
Yeah.
$1, $2 a stopper.
I think it's just lack of communication. The consumers don't know that's available.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. The Corvin, you have to buy the system, and that's like, you know, $100 something, a couple $100. Well, that was super informative, but we like to wrap up each episode on a more personal note. What is the most coveted wine in your cellar, and when do you plan on drinking it?
I already drink it, Peter.
Is this your Latosh?
That was my Latosh.
Your DRC Latosh?
DRC Latosh, well, I drink it. Drink
so
it during
you have
COVID.
To do what, you have to say what's next.
Well, I also still have a few beautiful bottles of Burgundy that I brought back when I was doing my sabbatical in Burgundy in 2016. And so, in fact, I just pulled those out. I was going to grab the bottle for this, but I didn't. But it is it's a very beautiful Burgundy from Bon Romani by a high-end producer there, but it's not DRC, so it's a different one. But yeah, I'm pretty excited about trying that wine.
When are you going to drink it?
Oh, I always save things like that for a special occasion, so it'll come up soon. I still have maybe a couple more years on it before I have to drink it. Yeah, and champagne. I have to admit, champagne is the one thing my husband and I go through the most in our cellar. It's like, I'll buy a case and then, you know, I go in there and I'm like, okay, what happened to all the champagne? Like, well, you took that one to somebody's house for dinner. You gave that one away as a gift. We drank this one. So I have to admit, I love champagne. That's always a crowd pleaser at my house.
That's great. Well, Liz, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing all this research with our listeners.
Oh, it's been a blast. I love talking about it. Thank you so much for inviting me and letting me share the good news about Wine Market Council.
Thanks for joining us. If you loved this episode of Ex Chateau, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, cheers.